And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on podcastufo.com. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Just a quick little announcement here. The Monday show that I've been doing, the Everything Else show, was kind of like an experiment. I wanted to see how that worked. I really enjoyed it a lot, the different topics and everything. Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to stop doing that altogether. I'm thinking of changing things around. The show's on hold for a while. And really, to be honest with you, I really kind of bit off a little more than I could chew because I've been extremely busy and it's been really stressing me out. So that show is going to change, and there may be a couple of other changes. Nothing bad, though, I don't think. So I should be making an announcement, I believe, next week. Our guest next week is going to be Jeremy Corbell. But tonight, coming up in just a minute, is Alejandro Rojas with the UFO updates, and my good friend Lee Spiegel will be on. We're going to be talking about all kinds of exciting things, what's changed in his life, and what's going on, what he's working on, and all that. So I want to thank you if you support the show. If you'd like to listen to full shows, you can. For supporting us for only $2 or more a month, all that information's on podcastufo.com. If you want to watch us live, you can watch us on YouTube. That's at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's also on our website. And if you can't support the show but you want to listen to the whole show, you can listen to it on the Dark Matter Digital Network. That's Thursday nights from 10 to midnight. And so that's it for me for right now. Alejandro, what's happening? How are you?
I'm well. How are you, my friend?
Good. Good. So is going on in the great state of the warm state of Arizona? We got snow. Nothing. We have snow here. Yeah.
I know. You know what? The other states are just in a terrible. The weather is awful. They're getting snow. They're getting low temperatures. It's horrific what's happening throughout the country in states other than those out south here, like Arizona, California. Yeah. I went to Florida not too long ago for a short period of time, just a couple days ago, and it was wonderful there. We had to connect through Colorado Springs, but I was able to witness the devastating coldness that and the pain and the difficulty that can cause just in breathing or just functioning. Life is difficult in those situations. I'm glad not to live in Colorado in the winter anymore, that's for sure.
I know. I'm not a fan of snow anymore, especially after last year. You know,
missing
the UFO
what?
Conference Congress because I had, you know, 9-foot snowbanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to. Yeah. I'm not a fan anymore.
Yeah, it's that's gone. That's why old people retire and we're getting old.
That's what it is.
And we move south.
I know. I hate to face that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with in the UFO world?
With UFOs, there's a lot of stuff going on. And of course, it's just because of tabloids, I think. You know, I've talked about this before in the era of UK tabloids. And begrudgingly, I've posted more tabloid stuff lately because they actually are picking up on some good stories here and there. But it is far and few between. Otherwise, they're picking up on a lot of really silly stuff out there. And so if you see these links and these stories to kind of the more silly stuff, you know, we just don't cover the goofy. In fact, there's this one, a big one that's kind of making the rounds. These UFOs over China Lake in California. And it's like this silver mirror finished kind of disc. Not even disc. It's hard to even describe kind of this object. Have you seen it?
You're not talking about the donut one, are you? Is that something else?
No, not the donut. That is something else. No, yeah. This you'll run across.
I haven't
it
seen it
it's
yet.
Getting
no.
bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Mark D'Antonio, who does the photo analysis for MUFON, and some people in the Open Mind UFO group have looked it over and pointed out a lot of problems with these pictures. But I have a feeling that there's going to be more news about these because they're really catching on because they look spectacular. You know, it's in the desert, California. There's a helicopter in the background and this weird, you know, mirror-like object. But it looks almost too good to be true. And you know, the shadows and lighting is all wrong where it turns out it is too good to be true. So there are a lot of kind of odd ones out there that just aren't panning out.
Now,
however,
when you say,
you know,
pardon me, when you say it's too good to be true, what did Mark, did he come to have a conclusion of what this is?
Yeah, he had looked at them and he got high resolutions of all the images. And yeah, he felt it was a hoax also.
Wow.
Yeah, lots of problems with it. And one of the big things with him was the focus. So he's able to tell the focal range or, you know, this technical stuff he does and was able to determine that it was BS. So it was a focal BS.
hey, now, does Dr. Bruce Maccabee still look at images?
He does. Yeah. He does once in a while. And I've seen him chime in even recently on a couple of things, but I can't remember what in particular, to be honest. I think it was on this Nimitz video, which actually I'll save that because, you know, we've talked a lot about this Nimitz USS Navy sighting.
Yeah.
And we've got some stories from Robert Powell on our side about that. And Jeremy Corbell has actually worked on this a bit. So I'll let Jeremy talk to you about it next week. Yeah. He's done a little bit of research. So it's a great case, but Bruce Maccabee did chime in on the video there. And Jeremy's probably aware of that. So I'll let you and Jeremy talk about that next week. Cool. Otherwise, this is kind of cool. So there's this group called the Data Duo. And they have a website. And essentially what they do is they work on data visualizations. They're able to take data sets and then make them really cool and interactive. And they've done this thing. It's these two people who work together. One of them, I hope I'm saying her name right. It's Pooja Gandhi. And the other one is Adam Crahan. And they do these challenges, these duo dares, and where they challenged each other with some data. And luckily, this last one, they challenged each other with UFO sightings. So there's a website called Kaggle that puts out data sets of information for these data cruncher people to kind of work with. And one of the sets of information they have is on UFO sightings from 1960 to 2014. So these guys made these really cool maps that show where all these sightings are. And you can actually roll over every single one of these data points, and it gives you information about that sighting. And they also have some more maps like about the country and stuff like that. So they're competing to see who's his best. I like Pooja's, but Adam is getting more votes. And they have a map. Now, I do write a story this week about kind of how, you know, this website Bustle covered it, and the data is misleading. So if you look at these maps, you know, it looks like the East Coast and the West Coast gets a lot of UFO sightings. But as I've shown in the past, when I've crunched these numbers, they correlate with population. So the more people you have, mm-hmm. the more sightings you're going to get. Mm-hmm. So what I did is even posted a photo of the planet at night, you know, where it lights up in certain areas, this NASA photo.
Oh, yeah.
Just to show, you know, it looks almost exactly the same as their map, because where there's more people, you get more sightings. So what you have to do, what I like to do, and other researchers, is look at the data per population. Because if you have more sightings per person, that means that's more likely you're going to have a hot spot. Wow. So I went to the Kaggle website and I downloaded their information and I figured out the per population statistics, and I did post that just to show that, you know, the states that appear to be where the hotspots are in a map where you don't do that are not really the hotspots. So just to show what really the hotspots were, Washington showed up on top, and then Montana, Alaska and Alaska, probably because they have small populations. But some of the regulars, like Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, those are kind of some of the states that are higher up than usual per population often. One of the reasons Washington, by the way, is at the top is that Kegel used New Fork data, the National UFO Reporting Center data, which is located in Washington. And so more of the locals know about it, so most likely more of the locals report to New Fork. New Fork is ran by Peter Davenport. Have you ever had him on your show?
I have. Matter of fact, we've been communicating. He says he's stressed out, but a lot of times he has been stressed out, and he's getting a lot of those prank calls, which is really bugging him. I don't know how he's going to deal with that.
Yeah, luckily he provides his data very raw, and he's done a good job. He's gotten his data online for the longest, so that's where they got their data. And typically I work with MUFON data, and I show the difference on this story. I wrote about this. But otherwise, yeah, we have a couple other interesting sightings up there.
Wait a minute, rendition. Before we move on from that, so can anyone find these images you're talking about that they're being voted on?
Oh yeah,
these maps. Anybody, I
wrote a story about it that you can find at openminds.tv. I found out about it through a story on this website called Bustle, which I linked to, and I do recommend people look at this article. It was a good article. Even though they missed the point for the population thing that's so important. And then in both of our articles, I've got embedded pictures and links to these maps. And I encourage people to click on the links, because you got to click out the link to do the interactive part where you can click on these things and everything. And that also takes you to their site where you can vote on your favorite map, whether you like Pooja's map or Adam's. But both of these are very impressive. These people are really talented, and they've created these just cool. You know, typically we have these what's called infographics, right? They're these graphics with a bunch of information on them, but these are interactive, where you can hover over things and it actually accesses the data and gives you information back. So,
wow,
really cool stuff.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of work. I wonder what Maine looks like. You know, we have like 400 people
Maine.
Here. Yeah, not too many people here.
400.
More moose, maybe more than 400. We definitely
really?
Have more moose than people.
I've never heard of a moose
sighting.
Yeah.
No, there was a deer sighting. Yeah, or dog sighting. There's dog
sightings.
But I
can't tell you, let's see where they fit. Because at least the last time, I did one in 2014. When MUFON still had really regular data coming out, and I did every state, they've been a little bit. I used to have access to more data from the MUFON database. Now it's harder to get, but they do send out email fairly regularly with their sighting numbers, and that's usually what I'll record to get the numbers.
Well, we do but actually
let's see
have
main fits.
We do have 1.3 million. I just looked. Of course, I'm teasing about the 400 people.
But you're number 39 when it comes to the number of sightings. But if you go per capita, you're number 9 in 2014.
Wow.
Whoa.
That's impressive.
Lots of UFOs in Maine.
Hey, I have I have on in the chat room online a supporter who's been with me from the beginning and he wanted me to.
And they still like you.
I know. He wanted me to ask you a question. He wants me to ask you, what's your comment? Have you listened to the Joe Rogan DeLong interview?
I haven't, but because I don't want to, because I don't know. And I've explained this, I guess, before, and I could see how maybe people might be confused by that, because I am not so impressed, or I don't have that much interest in Tom DeLonge's speculation. I'm not as into speculation. You know, we hear all day, every day, and Lee will tell you this and get it all emotional about it, and it'll be a lot of fun.
I can't wait. Yeah.
you know, we hear speculation from all the time, and the way Lee always puts it, unless you can show me something, you know, then it means nothing to me. And that's exactly, you're wasting my time. And, you know, for people like us who are writing stuff, you know, we're not like the UK tabloids where we're going to say, you know, Tom DeLonge thinks that aliens are bad and the government's fighting with aliens. I've talked to Tom personally, and he's a great guy. I love this guy. And a lot of my friends have different ideas about UFOs. You have your ideas. Lee has his own ideas. But, you know, I'm not going to write a story about it. You know, here's what Martin thinks about UFOs, or here's what Lee thinks, you know. I would rather write about what you can prove and that's what I'm interested about, what Tom DeLonge has done. He has gotten together, as we've talked about, some of the, you know, these high-ranking people that are extremely impressive, that have worked in intelligence, and we've never had these sort of people. That's the one I'm interested in. And because of their credibility, what they have to say is what I'm really interested in. So that's what I'm mostly interested in. So when he is trying to tell Joe Rogan about what he believes or what he says he's been told by people who we have no idea who these people are yet, you know, that's going to be a tough sell. So I can understand why Joe Rogan would not take him seriously. And, you know, even for myself, you know, Tom's a great guy. I really like him, but he has yet to produce, and he knows this, he has yet to produce these alleged witnesses who have told him some of the more fantastic ideas. Because you've spoken with Chris Mellon, who's one of the people that's part of his academy. I've spoken with some others in that group, and they're very conservative. In fact, you know, I had John Alexander on recently, and he's friends with a lot of these guys, and they have very similar perspectives, and they have had careers in the government. And although they're highly interested in UFOs, and they believe that there's a true mystery here, and people inside the government do believe that at times, they have not seen any evidence of some major, you know, cover-up or secrecy to the level that Tom is talking about. So they themselves are like, wow, you know, I'm not aware of what Tom's talking about, but if he does have these insiders telling them this, you know, we're interested in hearing that as well. So that's why, yeah, Tom isn't the one I'm listening to. When people say Tom said this and Tom said that, that's great, but you know what? Tom is a rock star. He's a cool dude. But if he had spent a career in the CIA like Chris Mellon or some of these other people in the group, then I would be much more interested in his personal opinions, you know, and ideas.
Sure. Good answer. All right.
So hopefully that makes sense.
It does.
And it is important to remember, like when it comes to the Nimitz case, a lot of these people in the media started picking up on this case. That's great, that Chris Mellon talked about, you know, but they're saying Tom DeLonge talked about this, and this came up in Tom DeLonge's press conference, and they're crediting the wrong person because it doesn't hold as much weight when a rock star talks about some alleged Navy UFO case. But when you have a guy from, you know, who worked in defense intelligence, and held very high positions, and he's talking about the importance of a case that the Navy jets were scrambled to chase, then that holds a lot more weight. And that, I think, you know, is something that we really need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, anything else real quickly?
No, I've got a couple other cases out. We've got at openminds.tv, including a couple with videos. So I'd love people to go over there and take a look and see what they think. In one case, I'm pretty sure they're balloons, but not quite sure. But it's always really helpful for people to take a look and share their opinions, because then we can figure out whether these things are truly mysterious or not. And in fact, we haven't really come up with a conclusion on the red blob. Remember the red blob?
Oh, yeah, I do remember the red blob. Yeah. The red blob. It was called
Red Blob.
The movie, The Blob. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary. Blob's going to take over
scary
the world.
Scary stuff.
Yeah.
Lee's old enough to remember that movie, so careful.
He might have starred in
mentioned-
it. No, he
yeah,
probably won't.
He
like
might
that.
Have some PTSD when he was a kid and he got scared by it. So,
all right,
be careful.
All right, Alejandro, thanks so much.
And, all right,
and I'll
thank
talk
you.
To I'll talk to you on your show on Monday, and I'll see you here next week at the same time.
All right,
all right. Have a good
week.
One.
You all right. too.
All right. I know. Okay, Lee Spiegel. How are you, Lee? Don't forget.
Well, I am the original blob, of course.
I thought you might like that. Yeah.
And yes to Alejandro, my dear Alejandro. I'm way old enough to remember those movies. In fact, I love those old movies more than anything that's coming out now. Oh. One of my all-time favorites is Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Oh my God, I can't tell you how many times I've watched that movie. I mean, I have the dialogue memorized. I mean, and boy, love it in black and white. There's so much stuff from the past, and I'm kind of dealing with a lot of these things now in this project that I'm working on with James Fox. We're going back historically, and we've come up with some amazing historical things. And David Marla, have you had David on your show yet, by the
way,
yes. Martin?
Oh, he was one of my favorites.
Wow, he is like such a wealth of archival information, and he has news clippings from all around the country that go back to the early 1940s, things I've never seen before, that when you put them all together and you kind of stack them on top of each other and you show them throughout this documentary that we're working on, oh my gosh, the stuff is quite dramatic. It's like it's almost as good as, if not better in some cases, as modern-day computer-generated effects on TV. Because the original newspaper headlines are the originals. This was the real stuff. And I'm just astonished at the stuff that David has in his archive. It's like hats off to him.
Wow. Hey, I know. I thought Dave was fantastic. And I've been trying to get him back on. He was at the time, last time I spoke with him, he was working on the L.A. incident, you know, the 1940, whatever it was. Doing a lot of work on that one.
Yeah, they referred to it as the Battle of Los Angeles.
That's what I just couldn't remember what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to be showing some interesting images from that event, and it was things like that that got the public all riled up, at around the same time that the pilot Kenneth Arnold made his report about the 9 Delta-shaped discs that he saw flying over Mount Rainier. And shortly after that, we had this incident in Roswell, New Mexico. And then, you know, a few years later, the big UFO flap over Washington, D.C., where groups of objects flew and were seen from the ground and also tracked on radar and chased by military jet fighters. These objects, the biggest concern that they presented to us was that they were flying in what's considered totally restricted airspace. They were flying in the restricted air corridors over the White House and the Capitol. That's a no-no. You can't do that and not expect to have somebody come and try and shoot you down. After you have first been asked politely to please leave this restricted airspace.
Right, right. Also, were they, you know, what is it that the device that an airplane has on it now that can be tracked easily? I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, I don't know.
But I wondered how long they've been around, and because now if it's some type of beacon that's in every, you know, commercial or any type of airline, that so they can identify it, and I just wondered how far back that goes. It probably doesn't go back that far.
Oh, I'm not sure, because I don't keep up with that part of the technology, the aviation technology. I'm much more concerned, literally, with individual reports by people like pilots, military and commercial pilots, which is not to say that I'm not interested in civilian reports, and I'm not saying that I find them more or less reliable than anyone else. It's the people who I really like to look at and talk to and interview are the ones who primarily are, they're kind of responsible for our public safety in the skies. And if they encounter things in the skies that are unconventional, unexplained, that can't be figured out, and such has been the case for decades, then, yeah, I want to talk to these people who are piloting these airplanes. And I have talked with many pilots. And, you know, these people are down to earth. And pilots who see things that they can't explain, they definitely would rather not report it.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so many reasons, as you know. The job security is one main issue, as well as ridicule. And, you know, it's like, are these really the friendly skies that we're flying through? The thing that I like to tell people, Martin, is, I mean, I hate to say this, but it is true. We don't seem to have a lot of cases where these unexplained objects have basically pulled the first trigger. You know, they don't seem to show initial aggression toward humans. It's always the humans that have the attitude of shoot first and ask questions later. Always. I think that's historical or historic. That's the kind of species we are, and it may be one of many reasons why any possible interplanetary society or group of planets, maybe they haven't wanted to invite us into their club, because we don't show any indication that we are a peaceful planet down here. I mean, sorry to say, but it's true.
Yeah, that's one of the things. Stan Friedman's mantras. Phil in the chat room reminded me, it's called a transponder, is what I was trying to. The word I was searching for.
Ah, okay.
God, I hate that when I can't remember something.
So yeah.
Hey, Lee, so a large portion of these people know who you are. You've been on my show. Last time you were on, I think it was July. But can you just give, for the person that's listening to you for the first time, a little quick nutshell background about you, and then you can end out on what you're up to now, and we can talk a lot more about that.
All right. Well, I kind of jumped into all this back in the 1970s. The thing that first caught my attention about UFOs was in 1973, there was a whole wave of sightings around the country. And for some reason, back then, the news media actually was reporting on these, because otherwise I never would have found out about some of these stories. And I was particularly captivated by one that to me still remains to me one of the best, most credible ever close encounters with a UFO. And this was something that was experienced over Ohio in 1973 by a four-man crew in an Army helicopter. And they weren't at very high altitude, but they all noticed at the same time that there was a light coming at them in the distance from the horizon, and it was like a red light, and they suddenly realized it was getting closer and closer and closer, and it was picking up speed, and they actually assumed it was on a collision course with them, whatever this thing was. And so they all braced for impact. And instead of colliding with the helicopter, the thing just stopped directly in the air, directly above them. There was no collision. And it had this glow about it. It shined a green light inside the helicopter cockpit. Everything was bathed in this light. And they could see the reflection from the light. They could tell very easily it was a cigar shape. It had no wings, had no tail, no horizontal or vertical stabilizers that you would expect on any kind of flying aircraft like that. It made no sound. It just hovered there in the sky above them. Now, again, this is coming from almost a collision course velocity to just stopping on a dime. And while they watched it, suddenly they felt their helicopter being pulled up as if, you know, we laugh about this, but Star Trek, Star Wars, we all know the phrase tractor beam because we hear about these things all the time. It's part of science fiction. Well, this tractor beam thing grabbed the helicopter, pulled them up, and they were watching their altimeters, and they went several thousand feet up straight in a matter of seconds.
Several thousand feet up?
Yeah.
Was it that much? Wow.
Then there was a bump, and the UFO let them go, and the UFO took off, and these guys landed, and they contacted headquarters and said, listen, we're going to the authorities about this, or we're going to the press, because we're not keeping quiet about this. Plus, there was at least one group of eyewitnesses on the ground who had seen this thing happen. And so they were allowed to speak to the press. And literally about a week later, I first became aware of the fact that the commander of the helicopter, Captain Larry Coyne, was going to be a guest on the old Dick Cavett show.
Oh, yeah.
The late night talk show. And I watched it, and I was just so mesmerized by this guy's story that, I mean, nobody was really coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, well, what they probably really encountered was the planet Jupiter. You know, and you expect that all the time. Mm. And they were just amazing. So this totally grabbed me, and I thought, well, I want to know more about this stuff. And I started reading books. So this was like in the mid to late 1973 and into 74. And it occurred to me that I would really like to hear from more people like this helicopter pilot. And I think the public would like to hear of these kinds of experiences that are so hard to explain. And, you know, without me taking an attitude of, you know, conspiracy, lying, cover-up, I never really was into that attitude or into that head. I just wanted to find out whatever I could. And one of the books that I read at the time was called Beyond Earth, Man's Contact with UFOs. And it was written by a couple, Ralph and Judy Blum. And I was really into this book because they gathered a lot of interesting people like the helicopter commander, Larry Coyne, and astronauts, politicians, other military people, psychiatrists, psychologists, law enforcement officers. And I was reading the quotes from the book, and I thought, boy, you know, I'd like to meet this guy, Ralph Blum, and tell him that I've come up with a possible idea that would involve his book, if he's interested in this. And my idea was, I'd like to hear the voices of these people. And it occurred to me, and this was back in the mid to late 70s. I don't know if many people in your audience, Martin, would even remember this. But back then, CBS did this thing with, they did these early television infomercials where they were putting out not just products like great flashlights and ways to, you know, decontaminate your home if you call in now. They were actually promoting record albums, vinyl record albums, the best hits of Mitch Miller and the Gang, or hits of 101 million strings, you know, great hits of the 60s. And I thought, boy, this would be great because they're actually advertising these recordings on TV, getting people to call in. And again, this was literally before there was an internet. And so I thought, boy, it'd be great to put a record together, like a documentary. So the only way that I really could figure out how to do this was to meet Ralph Blum, the author of this book. And all that I knew about where he was that he was working out of an office at NBC in New York. He was involved with helping NBC do a special news report on UFOs that featured many of the people in his book. So I thought, well, I've got to go meet this guy, Ralph Blum, somehow. I want to see if I can get him to want to do something with me about UFOs. And so I literally one day went to NBC and noticed right away that you can't just walk through NBC. The security was tough then. You can imagine what it's tough now to try and get through the security of a company like this. So I walked into the lobby and noticed that there was a large group of people milling around near the security desks. And I heard somebody mumble like, oh, this is really great. I've always wanted to see a TV show. And I asked them what they were there to see. And they were there for an NBC tour, and they were going to see a live presentation of Jeopardy, because that's what Jeopardy was done back then. So I just waited and waited and looked kind of innocent. And when the group was ushered through security to get onto one of the elevators to go upstairs for their tour, I just joined the group. Huh. I just blended in. Went right through security. Nobody asked me any questions. And got into the elevators and followed the group and went in to see Jeopardy. I figured, well, while I'm in here, I might as well go check out the show, because this might be kind of fun. So I did that, saw a couple of tapings of the show. And then when the show was over and the ushers brought us out into the halls, they said, now we're going to finish our tour of NBC News. So make sure you stay in line, stay with the group, don't mingle, or don't kind of wander off. And the group went down one hall, and I wandered off down another hall.
Oh, jeez.
That's exactly what I did. And I started going through one office after another. Anything that was indicated by a sign on the door that said newsroom or news something or other. And finally, I found a room, and I said, is this the right office room for Ralph Blum? And they said, yeah. I said, oh, okay, great. I'm here to pick up his mail for him and take it to him.
Oh my God.
And that silence was brought to you by my late father, who, when I told him the story, eventually he went, yes, that's my son. So
wow.
They, without asking me any more questions, they gave me Ralph Blum's mail, which of course gave me his address.
Oh my God.
In New York City. And they wrapped it up for me and put a rubber band on it and put it in an envelope. And I thanked them more than they could ever know. And off I went up to the upper east side of New York, and I found the building that was the I guess it was the correct address from some of the mail. And I rang his buzzer, because his name was downstairs, and there was no answer. So I rang the buzzer for the superintendent. And the guy came out, and I said, hey, hi, I'm a friend of Mr. Blum's. I'm just here to deliver some mail for him. Can I leave it with you? And will you get it to him? And he said, sure. So I wrote a little note on a piece of paper. Dear Mr. Blum, my name is Lee Spiegel. I'm not here just to deliver your mail, but I love your book. I have an idea that I'd like to talk to you about regarding UFOs. I hope I'll hear from you someday. And I wrote my telephone number. And I gave it to the super, and off I went. Like 2 days went by, and my phone rang. And I picked it up, and I said, hi. And he said, is this Lee Spiegel? I said, yeah, who's this? He said, my name is Ralph Blum. How did you get my mail?
Oh, my God. couldn't you realistically go to jail for doing something like that? I mean.
Oh, yeah. Of course, but you know, you do things. And there's a famous line in the first Indiana Jones movie, you know, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Marion and Sala are asking Indy, how's he going to do this next thing that he's going to do? And he says, I don't know, I'm just making it up as I go along. and
wow.
that's what I was doing.
Yeah,
we met. He loved the story of how I got his mail. And not long after that, Ralph and I found ourselves in an office at CBS doing a pitch to the CBS Records brass. And basically the pitch was, I would like to produce and write a vinyl recording documentary about UFOs. And we've already talked with Ralph's publisher at the time was Bantam Books, and Bantam wants to get on board. And the idea was, if when you sell the record, you say to your possible customers, if you don't like the record, keep the book as our gift. Mm. And so part of the deal was, and they let me do this, I wanted a television commercial to sell my album, because that had never been done before. You'd never seen anything like that. No big companies of that magnitude had ever gone on the air and tried to promote a UFO product. Mm-hmm. So I figured, well, I better put a good product together. And so I ended up going out around the country, interviewing so many of the people that were in Ralph's books, astronauts, really people in politics, law enforcement, military. Like I mentioned before, we put this whole thing together. They let me write the 2-minute TV spot for it. We produced the spot in New York, and it went out on TV. It was unbelievable, Martin, to see this thing on TV.
Did you ever get that recorded? I mean, do you have a recording of that?
Of the commercial?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've got it.
Oh, God, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, you know, I actually have been thinking that what I really need to do, I've got so many tapes that I need to convert to digital, including mm-hmm. Hundreds of tapes that I've done all my old interviews on, and I have that original TV commercial spot on an old VHS tape. So I just need to be able to transfer it to digital, and it'll be there, it'll be preserved. But yeah, I've got it. And when I look at it now, it's so odd to see it, because it looks to me now out of date 42 years later.
Oh. Wow.
So that was the first thing that I did. And one of the people who I met, who I became longtime friends with while I was working on the album, was Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And Allen Hynek, one day while I was in the middle of doing the album and producing and collecting interviews, he called me up and from Evanston, Illinois, where he was the director of the Center for UFO Studies. And again, quick background. For about 22 years, Dr. Hynek was the absolute scientific spokesperson for the United States Air Force, for the Air Force's Project Blue Book, yeah. which was the official. It lasted for more than, it was like 30 years, from the 40s into the 60s. This was the official military investigation of UFOs, and every time there was any kind of major sightings anywhere, the Air Force would send Dr. Hynek, who was a known scientific skeptic about UFOs, they would send him to the places and basically say to him, make this go away. We don't want any more public alarm over this. Just quiet it down and then move on to the next case. And he did that. And he ended up hating the fact that he had to do that, because along the way, when he started realizing that the Air Force was doing inept investigations about UFOs, and he started changing his mind, he also realized that many of his scientific colleagues were turning against him, because he thought that there really was something about UFOs that should have been investigated by science. And so he and I became friends. And as I said, one day I was working on my record album, and he called me and he said that he wanted to ask me a favor. He was getting these phone calls from police officers and highway patrolmen, sheriff's deputies down in Lumberton, North Carolina. They were seeing some strange object in the sky several nights in a row, and they were asking his help to investigate it. He had no investigator down there, so he said to me, I know you're busy working on your documentary, but do you have the time to go down there and maybe do some interviews for me with the police officers and just put a report together and send me the report. And if you come back with some really good stuff, I'll publish your findings through the Center for UFO Studies. So I asked him, what are these people reporting? And he said, well, it's something different than we've ever seen these days. Here in 1975, they're reporting something that's triangular shaped or boomerang shaped. And we haven't really had a lot of reports like that. And I said, wait a minute, are you telling me that you want me to go down to North Carolina and basically try and see a flying Dorito? Because that's what this thing sounded like. And I said, you know, I'd much rather see a classic flying saucer if I'm going to see anything at all. And he started to say, well, look, if you don't want to go. And I said, no, don't complete that thought, because there is no way in the world that I am going to piss you off because of who you are and that you've asked me to do this. I'm going, just on the off chance of getting some good interviews. You bet I'll go. And within a few hours of my arrival in North Carolina in April of 1975, I hit the jackpot. And I believe you're showing part of that jackpot on YouTube. Your YouTube channel right now.
I am.
Yeah.
The painting.
This is a painting of the most dramatic moment of the encounter. And for those of you who are looking at this, you can see one particular figure in the middle with his arms outstretched. Yep, yours truly. And you know, this whole thing started where the call started coming into the dispatcher's office, and we got into the sheriff's cars. We following each other through car radios, finally coming upon this field. Everybody got out of the cars, and this thing started from behind where the trees are that you can see there in the painting. And it was a field, a big field in between where the trees were and where we were standing. And this thing first appeared over the trees, moving slowly from left to right, just flashing a white light and a red light, and then back to white and red. And then it stopped at one point above the trees, and then it started moving slowly across the field in our direction. So we're just standing there watching and waiting. We didn't know what it was going to do. And it got to the point where it was directly above us, just like you see in the painting. And at that point, we could see there was a row of like white lights up one side of it, a row of like red lights up the other side with a brighter light at the apex. But it was because of the brightness of these lights that we could actually make out the triangular shape of the thing. It made no sound. It had no engine, nothing at all. No visible means of propulsion whatsoever here in 1975, rural North Carolina. And as we watched it, all of a sudden, this beam of light came straight down from it and hit the ground right in front of us. It was only on the ground maybe 2 seconds, 3 seconds, certainly long enough for my heart, which was pounding out of my chest. And the light went back up, and then the entire object turned an amber color, the whole thing. It slowly turned about like 45 degrees and then very slowly moved away, as if to say, I'm done with you guys. I'm going somewhere else to screw around with someone else's head at this point. And we got into the cars, and again, through car radios, we came upon different law enforcement officers who had just had their own close encounter with this thing. And probably the most dramatic of them, which ended up in my report, was I came upon a police chief who was in his car patrolling a lake. And I went over to where he was sitting in the car, and I said, all right, chief, what did you see? He said, I was just sitting in here, and the whole inside of my car lit up, just totally lit up. And I looked out the window, and there was this thing just sitting in the sky above me. And I said, all right, what did you do next? He said, I get out of the car, I opened up my trunk, pulled out my big official police lantern that we use for emergencies. I aimed it up at the thing, and I blinked once at it, and the thing blinked back at me.
Jeez.
I said, oh.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said, all right, well, Chief, did anything else happen? He said, yeah. I blinked at it again twice, and it blinked back to me twice. Jeez. So, you know, and what I want to say also about this, Martin, is that years later, when I was at a UFO conference out in California, I happened to meet up with one of the leading UFO skeptics, debunkers, in the world. And I don't mind saying who it is. It's Robert Schaefer. Mm-hmm. I've known Robert for many years. I respect a lot of what he does and a lot of what he says because I think skepticism is really important. I don't think ridicule is, and it has no place at all in the study of anything, whether it's UFOs, you know, Loch Ness Monster, unexplained phenomena, anything. Ridicule is the last thing you want to inflict on people who believe they've had a very special experience with something. So I'm at this UFO conference, and we ran into each other. And I said, Robert, you know, I've been meaning to tell you about something that happened to me back in 1975. Let's go somewhere and sit where it's quiet, and I'll tell you. I laid out the whole story to him. And when I was done, I said, sorry, Robert, you heard the story. What do you think I saw that night? Hmm. And he said, well, if you haven't changed the details of the story in all these years, and I said, no, I haven't. And there's corroborating eyewitnesses about this. He said, the only thing that I can think of that would fit the facts is that what you saw was a remote controlled kite.
That's pretty good with lights too.
I said, Robert, remember it was nighttime. It came across a field and knew where we were. It, at the right moment, shined the beam of light. How did it then get from where we were to where this police chief was? And it, how did it know that he was going to be blinking up at it? And what was he blinking back at it? I mean, doesn't this kind of sound more like an individual intelligence going on here instead of some yokel with like a like an old initial, I don't know, prototype Radio Shack kite? Because, I mean, who had this kind of stuff back then?
Right.
And you know, the other thing, Martin, is since you know David Marler is a really amazing researcher. He put together the most definitive book a few years ago on triangular UFOs. And we didn't know each other until after the book was published, and we finally met and have become friends. And he told me that based on his independent research into many triangular UFO sightings around the United States, the one that I was involved with was the first multiple witness, well-documented, close encounter of a triangular UFO in the United States.
Wow.
I didn't know this, of course, while it was happening. You know, I mean, even Alan Hynek, when he sent me down there, he said, you know, we haven't heard much about triangular UFOs. And this was 1975. This was like 22 years before the Phoenix Lights.
Right. Now, I have a friend who had an encounter with a triangle in 1978.
Oh, where was it?
That was in Massachusetts.
Oh, no kidding.
Yep.
Okay.
So I mean,
was it at a low altitude where he was?
It was a woman, and she was a young, you know, she was a teenager at the time, and she was riding with her aunt, and you know, they stopped the car, and she said, you know, she got out, but it was right over their car, and I think she said the thing about the no noise too. I'm going to talk to her again about it, but she said it was in the paper. afterwards. You know, I mean, other people saw it. There was other witnesses.
Yeah, it. I mean, it's so much more frequent now. You said it was 1978, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, then she saw, like I did, one of the early triangular UFOs. It was like well, the visitors, whoever they are, they were using a new model in those years.
Yeah, I've had people say that to me on this show. You know, so why is it? You know, why have they changed? Why are there, you know, the orbs, the cigar shape, the triangle, the saucer? What is the saucer out of fashion now? You know, but people do see discs still. You know, it's not like they're extinct or anything.
Well, you know, there's another thing that I like to point out to people, and I was leading up to this as well. This all happened in 1975, the encounter, putting my album together, and the helicopter pilot, Larry Coyne, was one of the people that I put on the album. And it was about this time that I was feeling like, okay, well, I've done this record album, and that was nice, and it's helped people to understand a little bit more about UFOs. But now what's next? What can I do now that is maybe new? And I thought, boy, somebody really ought to do something at the United Nations. I mean, because really, this is not just an American phenomenon. This is something that's happening all around the world. So, you know, people said to me, this was at the beginning of 1978, people said, you can't just go up to the United Nations, knock on the door, and say, hi, may I please come in and do a UFO presentation?
Did you ask them what their mail, if they had any mail they needed delivered?
Yeah. Can I bring some mail tomorrow? Maybe then you talk to me. No, well, and the whole thing, where that started was in 1977. Now, this was during the year leading up to Steven Spielberg giving us Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which became the big holiday movie of 1977. They just celebrated the 40th anniversary of that movie. But also in 1977, the Prime Minister of Grenada, a little Caribbean country of Grenada, Eric Gehry, was making several speeches at the UN. He had a personal crusade. He had a passion about UFOs, so he claimed, and he wanted his country to become like the spotlight of tourism or whatever. And so he came up with an idea to try and get the other countries of the world to put together a committee that could study UFOs together and share this information, and have a committee be a clearinghouse set up in his country of Grenada, so that Grenada would always be now the focal point for UFOs. And I watched some of these things on the news about, well, the Prime Minister of Grenada is at it again. He spoke to the UN today, and UFOs, and as in the past, nobody's paying attention to him. So I thought, aha. I had one of those aha moments that, again, my father really liked. And I, as you probably know, all the major countries of the UN, they all have missions, their own offices, and they're all kind of located in and around the neighborhood where the United Nations is. Makes sense. So I knew that Grenada had at its mission near the UN. I just looked it up, got its address, its phone number, and I made contact with a couple of the ambassadors there. And I introduced myself and said that I had recently produced a documentary record on UFOs, and I've been watching their prime minister talk at the United Nations about doing something about UFOs, but there doesn't seem to be any interest there with him about this. I have an idea of how I could get the United Nations to pay attention to your prime minister. May I come by your office, the mission, and give you a copy of my record album that you can then give to your prime minister and then see if he wants to talk to me. And that's what we did. Wow. We went over to their office. They were very friendly. They took the album. They said that they were going to get it down to him in Grenada. And I don't know how much time passed after that, but I got a call from them saying, the prime minister is going to be in New York next week. There's going to be a ceremony where he's going to be knighted and become Sir Eric Gehry. And there'll be it's a big ceremony with lots of food and dignitaries. And we would like to invite you to come to the ceremony because the prime minister would like to meet you.
Wow.
I went, great. Holy cow. I'll even wear a tie. I mean, really, I'll be happy to do that. Thank you. And I went there, and it was very cool to see that kind of ceremony happening there. And when it was all over, somebody brought me into a room, and then they brought the prime minister in, and we were introduced, we shook hands, and they left us alone. And he said that he really enjoyed my record album. And in fact, I think you've got a picture up right now on your site, showing the prime minister in the center of the screen. That was Sir Eric Gehry, and he said to me, "Well, what is your idea of doing something at the United Nations?" And I said, "Well, Mr. Prime Minister, I've been watching your speeches, but with all due respect, the United Nations is not paying attention to you. You're not presenting credible reasons for them to take you seriously. If you liked the record album that I put together, then you know that I had voices on that album that if those voices were to somehow come together as a group, the media would listen. And if they came together as a group at the United Nations, the United Nations will listen. I can bring these people together if you will sponsor my presentation idea." And quite literally, at the end of that meeting, over a handshake, I suddenly became a delegate to Grenada. Because I had to. And I found out also that not only can you not just walk up and knock on the door at the UN and ask to do a presentation, if you want to do something there, you have to either be a member of a country that wants to do this presentation, or you have to be delegated even temporarily by the country so that you are allowed. They gave me a special card, an identification card of the country of Grenada, indicating that I was an advisor to the country. And I had to show this card whenever I wanted to go into the United Nations throughout 1978. And the card got me in almost everywhere. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
It was, you know, I wanted to go up to people I knew and say, "Hello, please, can you pinch me? Because I can't believe my luck that this is actually happening." And what happened shortly after that, and I think this is also why I found out many months later that our State Department was watching what I was doing. After I made the deal with Grenada, I started getting checks from the United Bank of Grenada.
Wow.
They because they paid me not a salary, because I was working a night job in New York, but during the day, when I was spending all my time at daytime working on the project, they paid me expenses to do any traveling I needed to do, to collect documents, meeting with people, just going where I had to go, the things that just cost money for this presentation. And I kept lists and inventory and accounting of all this. But it was the only way that I could have pulled it off, because I wasn't going to do it on my own money. And so it was right about that time that I sent my actual proposal to Dr. Alan Hynek, who, if you're looking in the picture, he's the man holding the pipe in his mouth on the right of the picture. And many of your viewers and listeners might remember that in at the very last act of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm. Steven Spielberg put Dr. Hynek in the movie for 8 seconds.
Right.
It was right after the mothership came down, and Spielberg got a shot of Hynek walking out from the crowd of scientists, looking up in wonder, stroking his beard and holding his pipe. And that was it. So I sent Alan my proposal, and he wrote me a really long, great letter saying, I love your proposal. As you know, for years I've been trying to get the United Nations to do something on this. I and the Center for UFO Stories completely endorse what you're trying to do, and I want to be there for any meetings that you think I can be helpful. And on the day of the final presentation, I'll be there for anything you want. And I said, well, this is great. I want you to be one of my speakers. And can you maybe get this guy, Jacques Vallée? Because I haven't met Jacques Vallée. And now I know a little bit about him. He was the real life model for the French scientist in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I said to Alan Hynek, because they were friends, Alan was Jacques' mentor. And I said to Alan, if you can convince Jacques to want to be one of my speakers, I would be more than thrilled. And so that's kind of how that happened. I believe, I don't know if you've put the picture up yet, Martin, the other one that showed us in the middle of 1978, that showed me sitting around at the table with the Secretary General, with Jacques Vallée, with Alan Hynek, astronaut Gordon Cooper. We all had a closed door meeting where the Secretary General, Kurt Waldheim, and there's the picture, wanted to know what we were planning on doing later that year. You can see from the left, moving clockwise, it's Gordon Cooper, and Jacques Vallée is next to him. Astrophysicist Claude Poher from France, Dr. Hynek next to him, the Prime Minister of Grenada, Eric Gehry there at the head of the table, the Secretary General of the United Nations. You can see the top of the head of a man who was from the Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. The next guy who has all the hair like a werewolf, that would be me. And next to me is Len Stringfield, great UFO researcher. He was his name. And the last person in the picture, Dr. David Saunders, who was part of the initial government Condon committee that pretty much banned UFOs, but he was one of the people who wrote a book called UFOs, Yes! ! Because he was really upset when he realized that the government was not doing the right job in presenting its findings on UFOs to the public. And he broke away from the government committees because this was just not right. And so he was one of our advisors on this thing. I look at this picture and it's amazing. Even if I wasn't in this picture, it's still amazing to see all these other people there together at the United Nations. And that was in July of 1978. But even before this happened, this was not the first time that I met Jacques. I actually met Jacques a couple of months before this, in early 1977. I got a call from Columbia Pictures, from the publicity department, asking me if I could be available to come out to Hollywood and to meet with Dr. Hynek, Dr. Vallée, and Steven Spielberg. And I said, I think I can make the time to do that. Why? What is it that you want me there for? And they said, because Steven knows about your upcoming presentation at the United Nations, and they want to talk to see if there's anything that he or the studio can do in preparation as you're putting this thing together during the rest of 1978. And that's what we did. Went out there, had this meeting with Steven. It was great. Columbia Pictures provided me with information, production stuff, images, documents that I included in a document packet that we handed out to all of the delegates at the United Nations. And then later in the year, in November of 78, that's when we did our presentation at the end of the year.
Amazing.
What you're showing now on your site is just fun for me, because this is a picture from just last year. You went a little beyond that, but that's okay. We can come back to it. Last year, Jacques Vallée agreed to come out from hiding, so to speak, because he didn't want to do UFO conferences at all for many, many years. And now here's a picture before you go any further.
I can't change that. I'm sorry. It's on.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is a picture of Jacques and me in the background and Stanton Friedman next to us. This was the first time the three of us were together since 1978. And that was just last year at the International UFO Congress. Because Stan was also one of my speakers at the UN. It was just an amazing experience doing this, meeting these people, getting to know them. And I can't say enough about what it was like to be there last year with Jacques. We were sitting at this table meeting people, and he loved going to the conference. He loved meeting people. People came out of the woodwork, Martin.
Yeah.
And brought many of his books going back to the 1960s just to have him autograph the books.
Wow. Hey, good idea.
Yeah.
I couldn't get over how tall Jacques is.
Yeah.
He towers over everybody. Amazing guy.
His hair used to be much taller.
Yeah.
We like to laugh about it. I beat him out in 1978 with my hair.
Hey, Lee, this thing with the UN is so intriguing. And has anyone, Steve Bassett did his thing a few years ago, and I know Greer did something at one point. But is anyone ever talking about trying to do something like this actually with the UN again? Would it make any sense?
Yeah. Well, I've been approached by people over the years to see if I would be interested in trying to get like another country, a bigger country than Grenada, to try and do something at the UN. But I have to tell you, Martin, I've become a little jaded over the years, maybe even a little cynical, because my attitude about UFOs and about this word that I hate to use, which is disclosure. Mm-hmm. I have come to hate this word because I don't think it's not that I don't think that there's going to be disclosure, but I believe it when Dr./Colonel John Alexander says to people, there already has been disclosure. I completely believe that. And this brings it into a whole different realm of possibilities, because if there has already been disclosure, then why would we need to have another presentation at the United Nations? We need something different. Mm-hmm. And it's a very delicate thing, because as James Fox, film director, film executive producer, he's already created two of the best UFO documentaries in the world. The first one was called Out of the Blue. The next one was called I Know What I Saw. And what he and I are working on together now is the third installment of his UFO trilogy. And what we're going to do is not present the idea, as so many other documentaries do, the idea that, wow, what's going on with the government? Why aren't they telling us? Why are they lying to us? Why won't they release these documents? Why won't they blah, 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 blah? You know, too many conspiracies. No, that's not the attitude that we're going to take, or that we think others should take either. We are more interested in bringing the idea to the public that it's not trying to get the government to release what it knows about UFOs, it's trying to get them to diplomatically begin talking about what it doesn't know. Because we believe this is much bigger, it's much more complex than anything else. For many years now, Jacques Vallée has, when he used to do more interviews, he would go on TV or he would talk to reporters and he would say how very disappointed he would be if the answer to the UFO problem or the UFO issue would be so simple that we're just being visited by interplanetary beings from another world. He said, I hope that it's not just that, because I believe that it's much bigger, much, much different than that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly where I'm going. That's where James Fox is going. And the people that we already have in the can, in this movie, are going to back this up, confirm it. We have some amazing individuals that will make the public, we believe, kind of watch this thing and go, wow, I didn't know that, and I never thought of that before.
Right. I can't wait. I know it's going to be about another year. You know, someone will always ask, you know, about when this movie
will
come
out. We are in pre-production now. Mm-hmm. We're going over the next 7 or 8 months. We will be in production. We've got several other interviews that we're going to finish, and we're going to get in the can, and then we will go into post-production. And at the same time, the post-production is happening. Whatever the distribution deal is going to be created, so we can decide where's the best place to offer this first, whether it's in theaters, on Hulu and Netflix, on demand. We just want to make sure that it's going to get the best distribution. And I'm happy to say, and I'm so thrilled for James Fox. Right now, his first two movies are still doing gangbusters. People are still downloading them, and you can see them both. You can see them for free on YouTube, and people are still really resonating with these two movies, and that's just great.
Well, I'll tell you what, and I've said this before, and when James Fox was on my show, I told him that those are my two favorite UFO movies of all time. So I can't wait for this next one. I want to talk a little bit about some of the cases that will be featured in, and one of them I'd like to talk about because I had never heard about. You and I were talking on the phone the other day, and we're talking about the Ariel School and the Westall, where there were school children, which I know that James, I can talk about that a little bit later, was down in Australia. I watched a video with him down there on a news station. But about the Broadhaven UFO sighting, can you talk about that? Because I had never heard about it until you mentioned it.
All that I know, and apparently the people who were involved in this just recently, I think at the beginning of this year, they celebrated a 40th anniversary of this incident that happened in South Wales, and I think the town was called Broadhaven. That's two words.
Yep.
And what was, and it was, again, it was just like the other two incidents you just mentioned. It seems like historically there have been cases that involve groups of school children who have some kind of an encounter on the school grounds, and sometimes the school staff are involved with this now. And again, there haven't been cases or tales of abduction, but actual sightings. And in the Broadhaven school, the basic story was that in a field near their playground. And it was apparently one of just of many sightings in that area in 1977. And what a lot of the children did, which was great, they almost immediately after the encounter, they were asked to draw pictures, and they did. And there are some pictures that you can see on the internet that show them holding up their color pictures, and they're all remarkably similar, showing like a classic flying saucer, what I wanted to see in North Carolina.
Yeah, I just put that up on YouTube, the drawings.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah,
it's they're really very interesting stuff, and there's no, you would think that there'd be no real reason for children to lie about something like that, and we love these kinds of stories, and there was no evidence. Supposedly, the local Air Force base there said that they had no evidence of an actual landing. And some officer from the local base said something. There was a quote in the BBC story where he said, if a UFO were to arrive at the airbase, we would charge normal landing fees. there are great pictures from this particular story. I only heard about this story myself about a month ago. And I know a lady who used to work for the BBC. She lives in Wales, and she's right now looking into this to see if she can find any of the original children who are still alive to maybe do some interviews with them. But it's like this is just one of probably many stories like that. And people have asked me, well, do you think that the visitors, whoever those visitors are, do you think they feel more comfortable with children? Because the children are less aggressive than the adults on this planet. I don't know. The one thing that I do know for sure about the visitors, because I believe that Earth is being visited, but the one thing that I know for sure about them is that I know nothing about them.
No, that's perfect. That's how I feel.
You know, yeah. I really believe that. And you know, Martin, I don't care where they come from. I don't even care what their agenda is, only because this is something that's been going on a really long time. And, and you know, I there's another thing that I like to talk about that many people don't know about, that in for this 20, 30-year period in between the 40s and the end of 1969, I mentioned before, the Air Force had their Project Blue Book investigative study. And at the same time, when they closed Project Blue Book, I should say this for your listeners, Project Blue Book ended in 1969. And the final report to the public was the military basically said, in all the years that we've been studying this thing, We have not uncovered anything that is of any scientific interest of any sort whatsoever. there doesn't seem to be any national threat, any threat to our national security, and certainly there's no evidence that Earth is being visited by anybody from off the Earth. You know, end of story. Move along. Nothing more to see here. So that was 1969. But the thing is, and I hate it when you uncover stuff like this, that at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, the Air Force had a book, a textbook for its cadets called Introductory Space Science. And it was just that. It was a science book that only the cadets at the Air Force were able to get. Chapter 33 of this book was simply entitled Unidentified Flying Objects, a pretty lengthy chapter in which they outlined, when I say they, the book and the chapter were written by Air Force personnel. They told the cadets, there are many UFO sightings, bang, 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 here are all the possible explanations, and they give a list of about 10 or 11 or 12 different things. Misidentifications of planets, misidentifications of conventional aircraft, weather inversion or weather phenomena, hallucinations, bang, 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 and all the way down to the very bottom of the list, final thing that was listed was aliens. So they go through all the lists, each bullet point, one by one, in which they explain to the cadets what these things meant and the reasons why these could be easily brushed aside for real things that are unexplained. And so then in this chapter, it basically says we're left with the unpleasant possibility that Earth is being visited by someone. And I'm going to give you a quote right now from that chapter. The quote is, "The most stimulating theory for us is that the UFOs are material objects which are either manned or remote controlled by beings who are alien to this planet. There is some evidence supporting this viewpoint. What questionable data there are suggests the existence of at least three and maybe four different groups of aliens, possibly at different stages of development." End quote. That's from the official Air Force textbook that they were telling their cadets.
Amazing.
You never heard that. You never heard them tell that to the public or the New York Times. Okay. So that's the kind of thing. And that, again, that was from 1968. And a year later, Project Blue Book ended. Now, how do I even know this? How did I get this chapter, you asked?
How did you get that chapter?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked. in early 1978, when I was starting to put together materials for the United Nations presentation, I wanted to gather as many interesting documents, images, film clips, whatever we could, duplicate and give to every nation there at the UN. And on one of my trips to visit Dr. Hynek in Illinois, we were in his office, and I said, "Look, you know, Alan, we're putting some nice things together here for this documents package, but you know, I'm missing something. We need something that I would consider to be a smoking gun." And he said, "Well, what exactly do you mean, smoking gun?" I said, "Well, you know, forget the obvious, you know, a finger from an alien, a piece of their propulsion system, you know, an antenna from the top of the dome, you know. Okay, I know I'm not going to get that, but just something that will be hard to refute because of where it came from and who gave us to us." He walked over to his filing cabinet, opened it up, pulled out a manila envelope, and as he handed it to me, he said, "I don't know if you would think that this is a smoking gun, but take a look at this, and if you want, I will let you make the copies, and we'll give it out at the United Nations." So I pull out this chapter that I just quoted you from. Like, are you kidding me? Like, what? They said what? I mean, at one point in the chapter, Martin, they actually tell the cadets, from available evidence, we now know that UFOs have been around and in some cases interacting with humans for upwards of 50,000 years. And here are some examples. And they give examples.
Jeez.
from ancient texts. Wow. I'm reading this stuff and I'm going, Alan, are you kidding me? I was using harsher language at that point to him. But I said, are you kidding that this is what they were telling the cadets? Are you sure that we can use this at the UN? I said, where did you get this? He said, he was always like this. He was very subtle. He said, you don't need to know that, but yes, go ahead and give it out at the UN.
Hmm.
And I made like a gazillion copies of this thing. And you know, and this was 1978 that he gave this to me, and that we did it at the UN, and we passed it around. We gave it to the media at the press conference there. And, you know, not long after that, within a couple of years, I don't know the exact date, but suddenly we had this thing called the Internet that became our reality. Mm-hmm. And now people can go and they can find this chapter and they can look at it and read to their heart's content. And yet, you know, it doesn't seem like in the end, nobody cares.
Isn't that strange?
Yes, it is. I it's part of my frustration here in 2017 that there is all this stuff that's available out there, and people are very quick to make pronouncements about things that they know nothing about. Oh, well, that case was crap because I just say it is, and I don't think that could have happened, so it must be crap. Just you can depend on my credentials. And no, I'm not going to just depend on your credentials. I say to people, if you have spent a lot of legwork and done a proper amount of research and gone out there and made telephone calls, done interviews, gone to places like the New York or the National Archives, if you've really done some digging where you can finally come up with an informed opinion, then I will say, yeah, I don't mind listening to you. But if you haven't done this kind of legwork that I'm talking about, then, my friend, you don't have a valid opinion. And I'm asking you not to foist your invalid opinion on this entire listening audience, because it's not right that you do that. And I don't have a problem telling that to anybody. Just because I feel comfortable talking about the things that I do, because I believe I have an informed opinion because I've been looking at this stuff for 42 years.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
I said, speaking of that, would you like to take calls?
Sure. You have telephone calls?
Well, I do have that. If anyone wants to call in,
yes.
If anyone does want to call in that's listening live, that phone number is 603-967-4030. I'll put that in the chat room as well.
Wow. Well, you know what's great about that phone? Because I grew up in New Hampshire.
That's right.
That's a New Hampshire. No, 603. Wow. but you've got a 603 number, but you live in Maine. Now, how does that work? That's another conversation.
It was just a Skype number available. I don't know. Maybe I was thinking of moving to New Hampshire, Portsmouth, New Hampshire at one time or something.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I went to college in Plymouth, New Hampshire, just a few miles south of the abduction field of the Betty and Barney UFO encounter from 1961.
That's a beautiful, beautiful area and a really good college, actually.
Yeah, you know, when I was there, it was Plymouth State College. It was part of the three college university system. but since I left, it's now come into its own, and it's called Plymouth State. No, I don't even think it's Plymouth State. I just think it's Plymouth University. Or it could be Plymouth State University now, but it is its own university. I know that.
Yeah, right. So can you talk a little bit? Oh, we have a call coming in. Why don't we go ahead and answer?
Well, let's do it.
Oh, it might be. You never know what's going to happen. Hello.
Well, as long as they're not calling to throw rotten tomatoes at me,
yeah.
Let's do it.
Hello, caller. Make sure your volume's down on your computer. Welcome to the show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
It's Bobby from NC.
Oh, hey, Bobby. How are you?
How you doing? Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Spiegel?
Good.
I got some tomatoes I wanted to share. I got tomatoes.
Well, you can throw them, but they'll never reach me.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, what do you think about all the Mothman sightings in Chicago?
Well,
have you paid any attention to that?
You know, I actually haven't. I know that, wasn't it John Keel who did most of the writing about Mothman?
Right.
Years ago, and if I recall, weren't the initial alleged sightings more like in Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And well, there's been this year alone, beginning early in the year, this year, there's been several, I think it's up to like in the 30s, of multiple witness Mothman sightings in Chicago, and some of them were like police officers that are, like, you know, credible witnesses. And what they're saying is it's, you know, like a Mothman description, glowing eyes, a thin guy with bat-like wings that like will shoot up in the air and fly around, and it's just bizarre.
Let me ask you this. Now, when you say in Chicago, are you talking within the city limits?
Yeah, like downtown by the wharfs.
Hey, wow. Hey, I'm going to have actually Sam Maranto, who's been on the show many times, is actually investigating that. I know he's a UFO researcher, but he's investigating that. He's going to be on the show sooner or later, Bobby. So do you have any other like questions for Lee, like anything UFO-related or along those lines?
No, not really. I follow him on your show and also on Open Minds. I love every time I get to listen to him because he's brilliant, and he was there from the beginning, and he's a knowledgeable guy.
Well, thank you, Bobby.
He's a great writer. Your blog writing is fantastic.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add, I don't know if you guys have caught it, it was in the news today, actually it was on Twitter, but a couple of scientists have come out, and it was in the National Geographic, I believe, and they actually found fossilized trees in Antarctica.
Huh. Hadn't seen that one yet.
Wow.
Yep. That just popped out on Twitter. Twitter's where you get the first news first, I guess. Okay. Well, I just wanted to say, hey.
All right, Bobby. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Bobby.
All right. All right. Good night.
Good night.
All right. Antarctica, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, there could be many reasons for that. Could have been a pole shift, or could, you know, the tectonic plates that move, you know, it could have been, you know, something along those lines.
Well, you know, and then you'll get some people who are very into the old hollow earth theory.
Isn't it hollow and flat? No.
well, I think it would be more likely to be hollow than flat. Yeah. But no, I used to be, when I was younger, I was actually obsessed with the hollow earth theory and reading stories about how there were inner streams of fresh water that were coming out of ancient caves where there was a brilliant sun-like object deep down in the center of the earth, and that's what was providing the warmth for the inner inhabitants who fly around in disc-shaped objects. I was like totally captivated by this. So if there are fossilized trees, maybe some of them came from Antarctica, from the hollow earth. Oh boy, now I'm in trouble, right?
No one's going to believe anything you said the previous hour and a half.
Yeah. I know. I'm thinking, earlier today, I thought, what could I say on Martin's show tonight that will take away my credibility?
The hollow earth.
The hollow earth.
I was in, when I was in Phoenix, when you were out there, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were in the room with me or not, but Mark D'Antonio was on a radio show while he was in the room and arguing with someone about the flat earth, which is another one.
Oh, I was in the room because I think I was in there on your show when Stan Friedman and Kathy Martin were there too.
Yeah, yeah. And, but this was this was a different time. He was on another show.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I like Mark D'Antonio.
He's awesome.
He's really great. He's a great scientist, and he really, really terribly wants to come up with big evidence about visitation to Earth, but he's so good at coming up with logical reasons for things, and he's great.
I know. and he's really sharp because, you know, just for instance, I took a picture out my window driving to Arizona, or Natalia did, riding with me, and there was definitely a disc like flying across the sky. And ends up, you know, I showed it to him, and he goes, I think there's something on your window. So I went out to my car, and I looked, and sure enough, there was a little piece of grass on my window.
Oh, no.
Just like like a disc.
Did you melt into a puddle of just liquefied? I mean, I know. I hate it when that happens. But, you know, I'm the last person who will be in denial if I'm wrong about something. You know, I would rather somebody prove to me that I'm wrong and that I don't have my facts straight, and I'll correct it, I'll apologize, and then move on. That's all.
Oh, someone just looked up on the chat room, Lee Spiegel UFO Special, The Credibility Factor, 1975.
Yeah, that was the name of my record album.
Ah, okay, I see.
Thank you all for noticing that. UFOs, the credibility factor. Yeah.
Yeah. So this movie that you're helping James Fox with, you're actually a co-producer, yes?
I am. Yes, I am.
Yeah, which is very exciting. I know a lot of people have wondered what happened to the title 701. Some things changed. It's going to end up being even a better movie. I mean, originally it started out that it was going to be talking a lot about the 701 or so cases that were unexplained in the Blue Book, Project Blue Book. That's sort of changed now a little bit, hasn't it?
Well, the original idea was when the Air Force ended Project Blue Book in 1969, they had amassed almost 13,000 cases that they had supposedly investigated. And according to their conclusions on these cases, there were 701 that, according to them, they had no explanation for. No clue. We admit it. We don't know what this is about. But please, folks, don't worry about it. We're keeping you safe in the skies. and so that 701 has just kind of lingered. And several years ago, James was working with some people who wanted to create a film based on those 701. Because James and I feel the same way about this. Of all the cases that Blue Book investigated, he and I don't care at all about anything beyond the 701 cases. If it's easily explained, push it aside. I don't care. Let's move on to only the ones that have stuff about them that should be investigated. And so they started working on the 701, but things just didn't work out completely for all the parties involved. And without me getting into too many like behind the scenes details about that, it didn't work. And the people that were trying to pull all this stuff together, they went their separate ways. And I know that it was frustrating for James, because he had put these other two amazing films together about UFOs, and it wasn't enough. It was like when I was done with my album in 1975, my attitude was, all right, well, this is nice, but it's not enough. And it was that attitude that propelled me into doing something at the United Nations. When you get a taste of something like that, to do something that might have an impact on what people will think about stuff, that can be very powerful. And so James and I have talked for a few years about trying to do something together. And this thing came along, and he asked me if I would be available to work with him on his third UFO film. And I said, yes, absolutely. And the reason I said yes is because I completely trust him. He has total integrity. He's credible. We work well together. We have the same attitude about UFOs, so we're not out there trying to make stuff up, because you don't have to. You don't have to over-embellish anything about UFOs. The truly unexplained cases are so incredible all by themselves, you don't have to add to them. Just go with what you've got. Mm-hmm. And that's where I stand, and I'm loving working with James. We're having a great time, and it's amazing. He's introduced me to some really very incredible creative people, and I might not have met these folks if it wasn't for him. So we're going to do something that hasn't been talked much about, and I won't get into it too much, but a lot of people have been wondering over the last few years, like, whatever happened with this thing in the 1990s called the Rockefeller Initiative that involved the late philanthropist Lawrence Rockefeller, who actually paid a lot of money to people to come up with what was called an unidentified flying object briefing document. And its purpose was not only to give it to Bill Clinton and his administration, but to try and get this thing out there so that people around the world, leaders around the world, could see that there really is something going on around our planet that really could have amazing implications to humans. And when Lawrence Rockefeller passed on, his kind of initiative did as well. And there's a lot of stuff that's been out there about it that's just been dangling. And so we're going to be mentioning the Rockefeller Initiative in our story, because it has to be. It's something, it was an important document that came out. Mm-hmm. And we think more people, the public, should know about this document that this man created and gave to the Clintons. That's exciting for us to bring that to people's attention.
And what are some other cases that you're covering that's going to be covered in this movie?
Well, I will tell you this. This movie is going to open in a really dramatic way.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about it. I don't want to give any of this away, I don't think any other UFO documentary has done this before, and we are going to do it, and people are going to go, wow, this thing really happened? How did you guys film this? I mean, and it involves military people who were involved with an incredible pursuit of a flying saucer that was just unbelievable. And that's really all that I should say about it now. But it all happened. It really did happen. The crew of this particular aircraft all filled out independent reports of what they saw. They all matched. The reports were sent to Project Blue Book, never to be seen again.
Never to be seen again?
To be seen. In other words, if you were to get all the details about this case and to try and go into the Project Blue Book files, even with the exact date and time and place and circumstances, you wouldn't find it anywhere in Project Blue Book. It's gone.
Wow.
Gone.
Now, is this documentary going to have a lot of remakes of situations in them, like you're talking about?
We're going to what we're trying to do is, it's difficult as you can imagine, to do a program and rely entirely on computer generated effects.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because after a while, even the audience can get kind of jaded. Oh, they're just doing what I saw them do in the other movie, and But again, there are some things where the computer graphics these days are so good that you almost can't tell. I mean, case in point, geez, there are 9 and 10 year old young men and women, boys and girls out there who sit in front of their computers, and they've got Photoshop, and every day they're coming up with not only UFO images, but little videos that go viral instantly that are befuddling the skeptics because the stuff looks so good. And that's a big problem these days in trying to investigate UFOs, because until somebody comes forward and says, okay, yeah, I confess, I did that, et cetera, there's a lot of noise out there. But if you're using the technology that's available to you, where you can create something that looks real and you're not pretending to show it as if it's a documentary, that we had the footage from 45 years ago. If you're straight with people, and you put things on the screen that say this is a reenactment or whatever, so people know up front. I've seen documentaries, Martin, where as long as they give me the information on screen, they don't try and pull the wool over my eyes. And if it says it's a reenactment, if it's a really good reenactment, I'll get totally into it.
Yeah. I like them. I think some of them are really well done. I know they did, like, for Unexplained Mysteries. Isn't that what that was called?
You might be thinking of Unsolved Mysteries.
Unsolved Mysteries. Yeah, they did some like for the Socorro incident, like we were talking about last week. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name, where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from South Carolina.
Oh, hey, Ryan. Ryan's called in a few times. How are you?
Pretty good. How about you, Martin?
Good. I think Ryan Lee, we would call our resident skeptic who calls in, or semi-skeptic.
Oh, right. Wait, is it Ron or Ryan?
Ryan.
Okay. Well, nice to meet you. Thanks for calling in.
You have a question for our guest?
I do. No skeptic stuff tonight.
Okay.
I wanted to ask Lee, were there any, you just brought up Unsolved Mysteries, and that's kind of the subject of a call. I wanted to ask him, is there any show he worked on in the 70s or 80s that he is not commonly credited with, that he did work with as a consultant, writer, anything like that? Because I've heard some things over the years that he has contributed to some shows and not commonly credited with them.
For me, that's been more recent that I've been on some shows, like the Hangar One show, last couple of years, and I've been on a couple of actual longer documentaries. But going back to the 70s and 80s, no, I used to be interviewed on television shows, television talk shows, and radio programs, but I wasn't actually on shows, I don't believe, that I didn't get credit for, because I think I probably would have wanted even some little bit of credit to acknowledge the fact that I had something to do with the information that was on the show, especially if it was credible information. But more recently, I've been actually on camera and contributed to some other shows, and I haven't been very happy with the way some of these have turned out. I discovered the hard way that you can be part of what seems to be a documentary, and discover that the things that you said during the interview with you in the studio, that they can edit the things that you say and take them out of context, so that when the final presentation is on screen, you go, "What? I didn't exactly say it like that."
Right.
Yes.
And it's like there's nothing you can do, because you do a lot of these shows, and you have to, whether they're paying you or not, you have to sign a waiver and a disclaimer form that basically says, "I give so and so production company the right to use my likeness, my face, my words as part of this production." And man, I got to tell you, I wouldn't do that again. And you know what? This is one of the reasons why I'm doing this program with James Fox, because I'm going to be in this presentation as well as being on the outskirts as a co-producer, but I'm going to be on camera. Because we're going to be doing something about my encounter in North Carolina, because it's never really been done before on TV, and I'm going to be the one to do it. And in fact, we may even take the camera to the actual field where this all happened. This is one of the things I found some of the police officers that are still around, and trying to convince them that we should all go back to this place and say, "Here is where this thing happened 42, 43 years ago." I think that could be very powerful. And I want to be there. I'm not going to let anybody else play me. I mean, it's not an ego thing. It's like, I want to get it right, and I'm the only one who would know how to get that part of it right.
Yeah.
And James Fox knows how to get it right.
Right.
Hey,
Ryan, we're getting near the end of the show. Thank you for your call.
Just to be sure, real quickly, you never were contacted by Alan Landsberg about his old series In Search Of?
You know, I don't think, actually, he did not contact me, I don't think, but I was in touch with him. It was either Alan Landsberg or Robert Emmenegger. I think the two of them were partners back then, and they both did a a book and a movie called UFOs, Past, Present, and Future. And I think that it was Landsberg and Emmenegger. I don't think that he contacted me. If he did, he might have been asking me if I had any contact names or numbers of people who I might have interviewed. Because if this was in like the late 1970s, when I was starting out at NBC, he may have contacted me and introduced himself and said, "Hey, heard you on the radio talking about this. Can you help me find this person or someone?" And I would have helped without any problem.
In the series that followed the specials that you're talking about, they had some classic episodes, like the episode in 1980 called UFO Cover-Ups. That was the first time I ever heard of Jesse Marcel. A friend told me once that you had somehow contributed that episode, but you're outside of contacts. It doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. In fact, I interviewed Jesse Marcel in, I believe, late 1979, early 80. And that happened because Stan Friedman hooked me up with Jesse Marcel. He was the first person I ever interviewed who was there at Roswell all those years ago, and he was happy to talk to me. And I still have the original interview that I did with Jesse, and it's great stuff. And it's always hard for me to hear debunkers say, he didn't know what he was talking about. He was making it all up. He wanted like to be the focus of attention back then, and I didn't have that impression at all.
Right.
So I spoke with Jesse, liked him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. He seemed like a great guy. Thank you, Ryan.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Ryan.
Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes left. When James Fox was in Chasing UFOs, when I brought that up to him when he was on my show, he kind of like,
I know. I know. I always know how to press his buttons on this kind of
Well, one of the things was you were talking earlier about the cutting room, you know, the editing room, how they can make that was going on with those shows, because I talked to Travis Walt and he was very upset. Things just happened in the production of that I'm sure James is not even happy about, you know.
When you're a filmmaker, a lot of the production stills, the promotional pictures that the network put out about Chasing UFOs, they would show like a picture of James Fox standing in the field with a big like double-layered military vest on and holding one of these big video cameras on his shoulders and looking really mean just before starting to run out into the field. Oh, my God. Ask him about that sometime and just... Listen to his response.
Well, I think the funniest part of that show was when they were walking around with a night vision dangling in front of them.
Oh,
you know.
Oh my God! I know, I know. It's like, you know, like the phrase "get me out of here." My old friend Robin Leach was on a show for a few weeks on ABC called. It was a takeoff on Survivor, and it was called "I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here."
So, Lee, I'm really looking forward to this movie. Is there anything else you want to wrap the show up with? Anything, any plans that you want to talk about? I would
just say to anybody out there listening who is really interested in the UFO field or the subject, please don't believe everything that you read or see. I say that When I begin a presentation or a lecture somewhere, the first thing I say to an audience is, thank you all for coming here. And by the way, please don't believe anything I'm going to tell you over the next hour and 20 minutes. It's more important that you come away with the information that I'm going to give you and you go out and move on that. Find some more information. Make it stick for you. Make it have some meaning for you. Don't just believe what people tell you. Don't trust everybody, and you'll know when it resonates with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really will know it. There won't be a lot of doubt because it's not going to come from our government. It's not going to come from the United Nations. A UFO, trust me, is not going to land on the White House lawn or in front of the Kremlin. Ain't going to happen.
No.
It's not part of what the overall scheme of things is. I don't know what the scheme of things is, but those things are not going to happen. So you got to find other ways to convince yourself or believe that there's something really out there that's credible, that's worth looking into.
Thanks so much, Lee. Always a great pleasure to have you on the
show. Thank you, Martin.
And
great,
to talk
thank
to you.
You.
All right. You take care, and I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Sounds good.
All right. Good night now.
Bye.
All right, everyone. So that's it for the show, and I want to thank you. You're either a supporter of the show, listening to the full show, or you are listening live. Thanks so much either way. And we'll be back next week with Jeremy Corbell. It should be an interesting show. And again, thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.